from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny. Some people don't mind letting their lawns go brown as a responsible response to the drought here in California, but this is not just a time to grieve. It's a time to refocus on building a yard that can survive the future, whatever the weather brings. You don't have to let all your plants droop and die. You can still grow some kinds of food for your table, and believe it or not, drought-tolerant gardening can be beautiful. Experts have a lot to say about using water wisely outside, making choices about what to save and what to let go. We'll be talking about all kinds of strategies, and we'll take your questions in this hour of Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny. The fall planting season approaches. For garden mavens in the Bay Area, mindful of the historic drought, this is a time for hard choices, thoughtful choices about plant selection, plant placement, soils, compost, mulch, irrigation, and stormwater capture. If you do it right, you might win over the neighbors and start a drought-friendly movement in your hood. Or maybe not, but it's the right thing to do, and we have the right people to talk about it with us here this morning. We have Kathleen Brenzel, garden editor for Sunset Magazine. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
And Andrea Hurd, owner of Mariposa Gardening and Design in Berkeley. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And last but not least, dragged in by phone from vacation, Flora Grubb, co-owner of Flora Grubb Gardens in San Francisco. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. So glad to be here from afar.
Well, I guess I'll just kick things off by asking a question to Kathleen Brenzel. Should we just plant a cactus garden?
No, not necessarily. If you certainly live in the desert, you might want to think about that. But there are so many beautiful choices, Australian natives, California natives, that just create a gorgeous garden. What you want to do, though, is make sure we get through this drought before you do any planting, because any new plant is going to require some water to get established.
That's a good point. Like, this might be more of a planning stage. Is that true, Andrea?
Well, as a landscaper, I would have to disagree. A lot of people want to put their gardens in this time of year. I would agree, though, that winter is the best time to put in gardens, and I do wish that more people were more actively thinking about planting during the winter. Unfortunately, people are thinking of planting during the summer, but at Mariposa Gardening and Design, we work really hard to conserve water, and we have lots of techniques that we use when we put in gardens so that they become water-conserving gardens. But it is true, to put the garden in at first, they do require extra water.
They do. And I would add that as the temperature cools and while the soil is still warm, and that's typically early fall, is really the best time to plant, you know, for making the most of your water and your resources.
I should mention, whether you're planning or planning to plant or planting yourself, this is the moment to call with your questions for this august group of experts, 866-733-6786. And now that you put down the shovel and picked up the pen, 866-733-6786, or email at forum@kqed.org. We're checking whichever way you communicate with us, online as well, kqed.org/forum. Flora Grubb, I guess it bears saying that, for instance, with something like a cactus garden, it depends very much where you are. If you're in Livermore, where, you know, sun-hungry plants are just going to be happy as clams, it's a very different story than, say, if you're, you know, in the fog beshrouded Richmond district of San Francisco.
It's so true, but we're so lucky to live in the Bay Area, where our climate really is conducive to growing so many different kinds of things. And I think that early on, in the movement of what used to be called xeriscaping back in the day, when they started talking about drought-tolerant gardening, the idea that gardens needed to look a certain way and that way looked like a cactus garden really turned a lot of people off to the notion of using less water in their gardens. And now what we're able to see so clearly are that you can have a garden that looks any way that you can imagine it to be, and it can still use less water if you make thoughtful choices about which plants you choose and how you deal with your soil and your irrigation system. So it isn't the diagnosis isn't that we all need to have something that looks like the Arizona desert in our front yards.
If not the Arizona desert, then what?
Well, I think that the possibilities are actually endless, and that the even plants that you think of as having a very lush look can be very unthirsty plants. And so it's a matter of doing some research and going to the really good nurseries, and we love helping our customers to discover that there are a world of plants that have flowers all over them and have big green leaves and use less water, sip water instead of gulping water.
Andrea Hurd, I see you eager to speak there.
I want to agree with Flora and thank her for that thoughtful commentary. I think that we need to think about how, as a landscaping contractor, what I do is work on saturating the soil, thinking of it like a sponge. And once that soil is saturated, then you can very slowly drip water into the soil and have it absorb less water and continue to stay moist over long periods of time. And I think what Flora's point is that when you go to experts who are doing things like that, or using gray water, diverting your laundry water, your bathroom water, and using that as irrigation water in your landscaping, which is another thing that we do at Mariposa Gardening and Design, those types of things allow you to continue to use the plants that are lush or garden during the summer while not wasting water.
Kathleen Brenzel.
And I'd like to add also that the soil, the quality of the soil you start with is really important, and you want to dig in a lot of soil amendments so that it's better able to keep water in the soil. And the second thing is to mulch once you do plant. You know, put a layer of mulch around the plants, keeping it away from the stems, because that helps keep the moisture in the soil.
I was kind of surprised in reading up for this segment. You know, soil is a living thing, and you can't just let it go dry. It does need to have some water to survive.
Mm-hmm.
It does, and when we look to save water and do so by drastically underwatering our gardens, what we end up with is soil that becomes hydrophobic, meaning that when you go to water it, the soil just rolls off of the top of the soil. And so it's important to try to keep some moisture in your soil to keep from really having a kind of famine situation in your garden in order to keep the soil healthy and the plants healthy, and mulch and proper soil preparation really help with that.
Well, it's interesting that you mention mulch and other things. People are calling in. Scott in Menlo Park.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to introduce this to your topic because it's very conservation-oriented as far as water goes, and you can grow year-round, but I mix the growing of fish with my plants, and some of the plants are veggies and some of them are ornamental. And instead of soil, you use the waste products from the fish, and it gets converted from ammonia to nitrite, and then nitrates get sucked up by the plants, and the plants in turn clean the water that then goes back to the fish. It's a closed-loop system, and it's called aquaponics. It's kind of crude in the setup, but there's going to be more design coming along that will make it more of an ornamental thing in yards. But aquaponics, and it's marrying fish and veggies. And I think that I see the drought in California as simply a market force to push us in new and exciting ways of growing things. And I think it'll be a positive thing in the end, as long as we really need it head on. That's my comment. Have a great day, y'all.
Great suggestion, Scott. Well, Andrea Hurd, that seems to play into what you were talking about, thinking holistically about the way you use water outside of the house and inside of the house.
Right. And one thing that we have developed at Mariposa Gardening and Design, which is piggybacks right on what Scott was saying, is what we call the living fountain. And it kind of takes that technology of working with water and using it to irrigate your soil. But what we do is we take laundry water and we put it in a stock tank that's a constructed wetland, and we filter it through the plant roots and soil. And that filtration process through plant roots and soil actually bioinvigorates the water. So rather than treating it and taking all the life out of the water, what we're doing is adding more microbial activity into the water while cleaning it and filtering out all of the impurities. And then that cleaned water then goes in to irrigate your garden. So that water is not dead, it's alive. And that also helps. The plants need to use a lot less water because they're getting more of life-giving nutrients that they need from the water.
Kathleen?
There's another source of water that we should all be thinking of, and that is if we are blessed with rain in the fall, the best thing you can do is to try to capture that rainfall by installing rain chains around your house, by putting down rain barrels to collect it so that you can use it to water your container plants or whatever. And the other thing is by putting in a rain garden, which is a shallow depression filled with very well-draining soil and plants that can tolerate both rain and dry.
Does that sound like what you do, Flora Grubb?
Yeah, I also think that in the Bay Area, especially if the rain continues to be as sparse as it has been, that for many people, the first place to start is to look at the water that you are already putting onto your garden. And that for a lot of folks, many people are running irrigation systems onto their gardens and not really paying all that much attention to where that water goes and what's happening with that water. So a really great place to start if you already have a garden and you're already gardening, and especially if you already have an irrigation system, is to do an audit of your irrigation system and make sure that you aren't presently wasting water that you've kind of forgotten all about.
That you aren't watering the sidewalks, that kind of thing.
Watering the sidewalk, watering areas of your garden where there's nothing growing but weeds, overwatering parts of your garden that could be surviving on half as much water as you're giving them. An irrigation audit will often turn up quite a bit of savings.
Andrea Hurd?
I think that's a great suggestion. Another one is to just take out your lawn altogether. And what we do at Mariposa Gardening is meadowscaping is what I'm calling it right now. But we basically take out your lawn, put in a meadow full of native grasses that can tolerate our seasonal cycles of rain and dry.
Yeah, and the expansive lawn is going to be a common enemy, for better or worse, of just about anyone who cares about dry gardening. I'm always a believer that a small lawn can be a fine thing for a family. I think it's reasonable. I often tell the folks who come into our store that to have a lawn the size of a king-size bed for each member of the household. That way, if you want to lie on the grass or you want to play croquet or whatever it is that you do on your lawn, you can do that. But for many gardens that are not that well thought out, the lawn is just sort of the negative space, and yet it's using up more water than the entire rest of the garden. And so those lawns should for sure be the first on the chopping block when you're looking at lowering the water use in your garden.
Trav writes, a green thumb, my first house with a yard and a drought. Any recommendations on fruit trees that can get started with less water while young? Kathleen Brenzel?
Well, you know, apricots, a lot of stone fruits get by on less water. They do need some water to get started, though, and you probably want to plant those bare root in the winter. That's the best time to get them established. Lemons and other citrus do require more water, so I would hold off on those for now. And
so
just
those
go
with
the
California
fruits.
Citrus bug, you've just got to let it go for a
that's
bit.
That's right, and then wait till winter and plant things like apricots and
Andrew,
there is a lot of...
Oh, sorry, Flora.
There's a lot of information, though, that there's almost no way that we can garden, grow food in our own gardens at home that makes it more energy consumptive than buying food at a grocery store. So I think that the exception of when you're growing your own food and really eating it, not growing your own food for ornamentals, but for really eating your food, I think that's a fine time to use water on your garden, and that your personal water usage will go down because and the energy usage will go down in getting food to you if you're growing it in your own yard. We've heard from a lot of folks who have decided not to plant a vegetable garden because of the drought, and I think it's pretty wrong-headed. I think you save energy when you grow your own food, and it takes more energy to get food to you when it's grown somewhere else.
Kathleen, do you agree with that?
I totally agree with what Flora just said, and I also believe that it's a matter of priorities. If you only have so much water to spend on your garden, you decide, where do I want to put that water? And I think putting it on a vegetable garden makes total sense, and we do that at Sunset.
Andrea Hurd?
Just another suggestion. I know that the Urban Farmer carries laundry to landscape kits that are DIY kits for homeowners to be able to divert your washing machine water to your landscape. And fruit trees is a perfect use for that because you don't have to expose any of the water over above the ground, and it will provide a lot good heavy dose of water for those fruit trees to get them established. And so that's just one suggestion for that type of application.
Kathleen, I'm wondering if you can talk about how to make decisions as to what to prioritize. You were just mentioning right there, right? Like, do you want to grow food for the table, or you know, are you looking for ornamental things? How do you start to think about that?
Well, the main thing is, how much water do you have to spend? And in some communities around the Bay Area, we're mandated to cut 20% of our water use. So that means if I have a lawn, I'm probably going to let that go because that's easy to replace. If I want to save established trees like Japanese maples and so forth, then those may need some water. So I would start, save your established trees, save your shrubs, let the lawn go, and then think about fall planting and prioritize that way. keep your vegetables going.
Andrea?
I think those are all really great suggestions. I would just add that when you're thinking about prioritizing, I also prioritize for habitat. I come from a permaculture background, and so it's basically food and plants will provide habitat for primarily bees, butterflies, and songbirds is what we work on in Mariposa Gardening. And then beyond that, I think there's a lot of different ways that you can make those native plants and those drought-tolerant plants that, like Flora was saying, that will produce a lot of beautiful flowers and do provide nectar for the bees and the butterflies, make those really work in your garden by giving your garden seasonal interest.
Yes, you want to follow?
I totally agree with that, and I would say fall is a great time to plant native plants, and many beautiful ones do attract pollinators. That's something that I totally agree is very important. You plant ceanothus and things like that that bloom in spring. And
now, if it's a native plant, is it still going to need water to establish itself?
What we do is the first year we give it more water than you would over the lifetime of the plant. But that still is going to be less water than something like a rose needs to be established, for example, an ornamental rose, which I love roses. My daughter is named Rose. I come from Portland, the city of roses. But most ornamental roses just aren't providing enough beneficial habitat in the garden. Native roses, for example, are a beautiful alternative that we use at Mariposa. So there's lots of ways you can get around those things if you spend some time thinking about it.
Flora Grubb, do you take a position on roses?
Here's what I take a position on. It's important to remember that we garden, most of us, because we love gardening, and that it's important to have a garden that you love. And when you're thinking about prioritizing, I think you need to ask yourself, which part of my garden is bringing me the most pleasure, and where is most of my water going? And that's when the lawn really starts to get afraid, is because when you think about your garden, it's mostly the lawn isn't really bringing you the most pleasure. If your roses are what is bringing you the most pleasure, then when you're thinking about budgeting your water, it may be that you keep your favorite roses. Or there are certainly roses like the Cecil Bruner rose, which is a big, easy rose, which you'll find in gardens that have been long since abandoned, thriving on no additional water. But it's a matter of where your love is and making sure that you're dumping your water where it's bringing you the most joy.
I love that the tenor of this conversation is steering away from a sort of rigid ideology. You must do this. You must not do that. It really seems to be taking into account how individuals use their yards and also where they're located and what their personal priorities are. Nicole writes, "We landscaped our backyard just before the governor declared drought. Due to restricted watering, my young trees are starting to show signs of drought stress with early browning of leaves. What can I do to keep the trees healthy?" Andrea Hurd.
Well, as a landscaper and a contractor, I see this happen a lot. And I think what happens, especially when there's a new landscape put in, is that you take out everything else and the soil is really dry because most likely it's been neglected for a while. And just like Flora was saying earlier, soil can be hydrophobic just like a sponge. Water will bead up and roll off the top. And just like a sponge, it takes a while for that soil to actually saturate. Once that soil is saturated, you can cut way back on the amount of water that you need to use. But it's really important to check that saturation level down 8 inches. If you can dig down 8 inches and see dry soil, just continue to slowly, slowly, slowly drip water on it. You can just very, very, very slowly put a hose, a little leaky hose on it, very, very slowly drip for an hour or more, just so that the water's not running off the soil, but is actually giving the soil time to soak in. You might need to do that over a period of several days to soak the soil down 8 inches, enough so that then you can really cut back on the amount of water that you're putting in. But if you're going to just run a sprinkler or a sprayer where the water is running off the soil, you're going to waste a lot of water that way. So slow, slow dripping over long periods of time sends the water down way deep into the soil.
Kathleen?
At this point, it's really worth laboring because I think that people, it's actually very difficult to water a garden correctly. And really experienced gardeners still get it wrong. You can do some experimenting where you run the hose for a while on that slow drip and then dig down and see how deep it's gotten wet. And you'll often discover that you haven't gotten your garden anywhere near as wet as you might have thought that you did. And that it really takes a slow, slow, steady drip for a pretty long time to get the water deep enough to especially to establish the roots of a young tree like the caller was asking about.
Kathleen.
And I would suggest that the reader try a soaker hose and wrap it around the drip line of the tree, which is where the canopy of leaves ends, and then halfway in between, and slow drip, very slow drip, to get the water 18 to 24 inches deep. And then maybe try drilling holes also every few feet around there and putting mulch in it to increase penetration.
Let's turn now to Gennaro in Oakland.
Yes, I wanted to ask what type of mulch is the best to use in terms of providing organic material to the plants. And then also I wanted to ask about alternative options for grasses that are more drought tolerant and that you could have a lawn without having to water so much.
Both great questions. Andrea Heard, you want to tackle the mulch question first?
I can do both questions. I'll try to be quick. The first question, what I do when we build a garden is we put down compost over the soil. Well, we sheet mulch, then we put down compost, and then we put down a quarter-inch fir mulch. The quarter-inch fir mulch is going to decompose quickly over time, maybe a year, and that's good. That decomposition is what you want. So that hot compost next to the small pieces of mulch allows a lot more organic activity to build up in the soil. And a quick thing on the grasses, all of our California native grasses do really well here during our dry summers and our wet winters, or hopefully wet winters. And we plant a lot of meadows using native grasses. I mean, it's almost the only calls we're getting right now is for people to take out their lawns and put in native meadows, which is wonderful. The grass plugs can be hard to get right now through retail locations, although probably nurseries like Flora Grubbs could help you with that. And then a landscape contractor such as ourselves could also help you sourcing those native meadow plants. Although the nurseries are carrying bigger gallon-sized plants. And so you can also buy seeds from Larner Seeds.
Well, Flora Grubb, are you getting a lot of requests for native grasses?
We do. We carry a good little selection of native plants, and we also recommend other ground covers that are less grassy, but plants like Daimondia and different kinds of thyme, and there are various ground covers that hug the ground a little bit more tightly and can be walked on once they're well established.
You know, Kathleen Brenzel, this might come off as a sacrilegious question, but what about fake grass?
Well, I have to tell you, a lot of people are experimenting with it, but that it has its downsides as well. I mean, you know, if we think about, their lifespan of 10 years or whatever, and then what do you do with what's left? I kind of think maybe drought-tolerant ground covers make more sense.
The better way to go. You're nodding in agreement, Andrea.
Well, ecologically speaking, anytime you're using extra plastic, you're not doing the earth any favors. And so, you know.
Or even green cement, right?
Right.
Painted cement.
Yeah, because then with cement, you've got a non-permeable surface. And what we want to do is provide permeable surfaces so that the rain can actually soak into the soil rather than run off and pull pollution down to the bay through the storm drains.
Well, we're talking about water-wise gardening in the midst of a major drought. If you've got a question for our experts, we want to hear from you. Call us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're talking about drought-tolerant gardening here in the Bay Area, taking and answering your questions and comments. Peter emails to say one precaution people need to take when capturing rainwater or storing gray water is to avoid using uncovered or unsealed containers where mosquitoes can breed. Given the situation with West Nile virus and yellow fever, lots of mosquitoes moving around in the hot weather. It seems like a great point, Andrea Heard.
It is a great point. And my suggestion is, and we do that a lot too, and the idea is to fill those depressions either with plants or with pebbles. Pebbles allow the water to actually build up in the soil a little bit. And as long as the water level doesn't rise above the level of the pebbles, so you just get it to the grade of the soil, then mosquitoes can't actually lay their eggs in those little pebbles.
Kathleen Brinzo?
The other thing is to buy a rain barrel if you're using one of those that's covered on the top, and they do sell them for that purpose.
Beautifully put. Peter writes, can you ask the panel to explain the distinction between drought tolerant and low water use? Just because a plant tolerates dry conditions does not mean it does well in these conditions. Flora Greb, do you want to jump in there?
Well, it's all a little tricky because when we talk about drought-tolerant gardening, which has kind of become the catch-all phrase to describe using plants that need less water, we aren't really referring mostly to plants that can tolerate a drought. In the Bay Area, no matter if there's a drought or not, it doesn't rain for many months. And during those months, we water most of the plants that we plant. And so we're speaking now about a real drought to an area that already has long dry periods. So it's all a little bit tricky, and I think that what's important to think about is, yeah, how can you get your plants to thrive in your garden using the very least amount of water possible? And that's a matter of the practicalities of how you water and which plants you select, and how you describe them doesn't really matter too much.
Kathleen Brinzel?
I agree with that, what Flora just said, and I also think that the best thing you can do is to choose appropriate plants for your region. Obviously, if you live in foggy San Francisco, things are going to thrive here that won't thrive in San Jose.
And vice versa.
So you look at what's growing naturally and take your cues from, what's growing in the hillsides. Is it ceanothus, whatever, and bring that into your garden.
Andrea Hurd?
I think that's very true. In addition to how you treat the soil, giving it a lot of good organic material allows it to act more like a sponge and retain water for longer periods of time.
Well, following along this very train of thought, Tom emails, how can I keep water longer in my sandy Napa County soil? Compost or the commercially available compost, CG from green waste recyclers or from local rock and soil companies, a good choice for this? As is, I water one day and need to water again a day or two later at this time of year. Andrea Hurd?
Well, if you're in Napa or someplace more rural, I would also suggest horse manure or some sort of source of manure that's readily available. Will also add a lot of organic content to your soil and also high fertility to your soil, which if your soil tends to be more on the dry side, at least keeping it more fertile with organic material does help your plants become more drought tolerant, even if they aren't naturally or typically so.
Nicole in Oakland.
Hi, I was glad to hear people talk about growing vegetables and using their water for that. I run an urban homesteading company called Farm Curious in Oakland, and one thing that we've been showing people that they've been excited about is ollas. So ollas are kind of a clay pot that you plant under the ground, and then you can grow vegetables around them. You fill the pot with water, and the water goes directly to the roots. Instead of running off the sponge, like your guest was talking about, the water is exactly where you need it to be, and you don't have to water as frequently.
Good thought. Anyone want to jump in there? Yeah.
Oh, I just think that's a great suggestion. Thank you.
Nate writes, I've designed and built a small garage for an extensive drought-resistant green roof, but have not located a local supplier for drainable soil, water retention mats, or root barriers. Online sources seem to cater to larger projects, not layouts like mine with a footprint of 150 square feet. Any suggestions?
You know what? My first stop would be, again, the urban farmer to get some suggestions from them, because if they don't carry those materials, they'll know who does, and they know the industry well enough to be able to point you in the right direction.
Let's turn now to Dawn in Castro Valley.
Hi, my name is Dawn Givelmeyer. Sorry, I'm in Old Navy school shopping with my children. We are sheet mulching our 3,000-square-foot home that we bought in December 2013. And more of a comment, I feel like I'm an evangelical on the corner trying to get people involved and get them to turn their cultural norm from this green lawn into drought-friendly area that attracts beneficials. Any suggestions in just kind of bringing people in to try and
change their view on the lawn?
Don, that's a great question. And I think there are an awful lot of people who feel just like you do. How do we spread the good word? Kathleen Brenzeld, do you deal with people who need to be converted, shall we say?
Yes, and I think the best way to convert them is, number one, success, seeing a garden that they really love. The second thing is confronting the truth, which is the amount of water that a green lawn uses versus a front yard with, say, native plants and a dry stream bed and pollinating plants and so forth. And those studies have been done and they're out there, and you can save many thousands of gallons of water over the course of several years by using native plants and so forth versus lawn.
Flora Grubb, I imagine when people come to you, they're maybe already on board with the idea they don't want a boring old green lawn?
You know, I think sometimes they are and sometimes they aren't, but we've always believed that you lead with beauty and you lead with the pleasure and you follow up with the rhetoric later. But when people see your beautiful garden thriving and when you start sharing your vegetables that you've grown with them and when they see you and your family out in your yard enjoying your garden and the fruits of your harvest, they'll get inspired and they'll start looking at their own expansive lawn and wondering if it could do more for them.
Aaron writes in to say that a lot of municipalities are trying to sweeten the deal. Alameda County has incentives to replace your lawn with rebates on water savings, lose your lawn on bay-friendly landscaping. Marin County and Petaluma also have programs. The North Marin Water District website has incentive information. Marcia writes in with a challenging question. In this time when we have a serious bee die-off, the bee people are teaching us that typical mulch is not good for bees. Please pay attention to the whole system and all the issues. So bees versus mulch. Is this an issue either of you guys have had to address?
She's probably talking about the native bees who do make their nests in the ground as opposed to other honeybees. And yes, I've heard that mulch does kind of impede that. They can't get in and out of their nests.
Andrea,
yeah,
If
you're lucky enough to have a garden of some size, you can definitely pick an area of your garden where you can leave the ground bare for the bees and have it be in a location where the plants surrounding it don't need very much water. And that's a great way to create a little bit of habitat for the native bees that do burrow into the ground.
Andrea Hurd?
Would have been my exact suggestion. Just locate it sort of like maybe in the back corner under some trees so that they also feel protected.
But it's not an either-or scenario. We're not talking about either mulching your entire garden or leaving your entire garden bare for bee habitat. You can definitely accommodate both in any reasonably sized garden.
Jeffrey in Woodside. Hi.
Yeah, I was curious. I was making mulch or compost, and I was adding meat products to it. Is that good?
I see Kathleen Brenzel shaking her head. No.
No. I think the best things are vegetable scraps and that sort of thing, garden debris, but I don't think I'd put any meat in there. In fact, it can be dangerous.
Well, when I had a farm in Vermont, we composted with meat, but that was bigger and it was easier to keep it contained. If you're on a big rural area, I think you can do it and you can do it safely. However, if you're in an urban or suburban area, you're just inviting a lot of problems, including rats and pests.
Rats. Mm-hmm. You know, one listener wrote in to ask about raccoons and how to fend them off. And I guess one way would be to not put meat in your compost.
Yeah.
Or leave
yeah,
any food
or fertilizers that are animal-based either. They're attracted to those as well.
Yeah. You know, that's a good question. What is it, aside from drawing in critters, what is it about the meat products that makes it not so good for your gardening purposes?
That's it. It's harder to compost meat. I think it takes longer to decompose, and so you have to be more attentive to the way that you're managing your compost pile, turning it more regularly, adding more carbonaceous material so that it'll help break down the meat, and it just takes a little bit longer. But it's not that it can't be done. But in the cities and urban areas, I think it's the pests that are the real issue.
Well, Jeffrey, great question. Thank you for asking it. You know, we've kind of touched on this, but haven't delved too deep. So just given the situation, is this a good time to rip out a lawn and replace it and establish a new landscape because of the water involved? Should people just wait until the rains come again?
I would say right now in August is probably not the best time to rip out a lawn and start over with something else. You could leave the lawn in place. You could start solarizing or whatever you're going to do, putting down mulch and so forth to kill the grass and get ready, prep the soil, and then you can come in and do your
Get your blueprints out, start to think about what you want to add in.
And when the temperature's cool, that's the time to start thinking about replacing.
It is an okay time to replace a lawn with rock or gravel or decomposed granite or some other material. Of course, if you're going to replace your lawn with a patio, that's a fine time to do that.
Andrea? I would say if you're interested in a meadow, you can get away with putting in native meadow grasses during August. But I would say if it's a homeowner doing their own garden, I think it is a good idea to wait. If you hire a landscaper, a contractor who can help you put in a meadow or some living things this time of year with an eye towards conserving water, I think that's an okay option as well.
Heather in San Jose has an interesting challenge.
Good morning. I'm calling because I inherited a kind of formal English garden sort of thing from the previous owners of my home. And it's never been us, and it seems like it takes an awful lot of effort for gardeners to come in and trim down the little tiny hedges and keep everything groomed. And my tactic this summer has been I've turned off the water. The only thing I don't want to have die are the very old roses that are beautiful. Everything else, I don't really care. But I'm wondering, like, how long generally can I let these little hedges go without water before they start looking ratty? And then what do I do getting rid of everything and putting in native stuff that doesn't overgrow and get crazy?
Kathleen Brenzel, you've talked about this.
Well, first of all, I don't know what kind of roses you grow, but many old roses, as Flora mentioned earlier, don't need a lot of water. That Cecil Bruner is absolutely wonderful. And then there are others, the Lady Banks rose, that just, you know, you could all but ignore those. But you might want to think about what if you want to maintain this English look, how can you do that with less water-intensive plants?
It doesn't go at all. I mean, I've got this, like, little Spanish-style house, and it looks very weird with an English garden out front. So
Spanish style rose garden? Does such a thing exist?
Well, no. The house is a Spanish style.
Oh, that's
house,
what I'm saying. Like trying to find something that sort of marries the two disparate concepts.
Yeah. Well, there are only three of these old roses. They're old Joseph's Cope roses, and I don't. Mm. They've been here at least 20 or 30 years, I think.
Well,
but everything else, I've got little hedges and little bushes and a bunch of vinca vine, and I'm wondering, can I just let it go for the summer and see what happens? And then when stuff dies off, what do I pull out?
Yeah.
You might want to gradually think of introducing plants that maybe achieve that look, but with drought tolerant plants. And I'm thinking of low hedges such as some of the salvias, Mexican sage, Salvia lucantha is wonderful, and it has kind of a romantic look to it, but it's also very drought tolerant. You could gradually introduce some of those as you remove those hedges that you don't like.
It may be that the plants that you're not loving in your garden too, maybe being tended in a certain way that makes them less appealing to you. They're, you know, when plants are hedged really aggressively, they turn into these little round blobs. But some of those same plants, if you just let them go, become a plant with a beautiful form. And it may be that there is more worth saving in your garden than you're seeing at first. And so if you continue to water sparingly and have the garden stop being pruned so aggressively, it may be that you find that there's something there of value.
Well, we've got lots of people writing in, so I want to keep plugging along. Alan put in a drought-tolerant native garden in the front and much in the back 3 years ago. For most plants, just one 30-minute watering per month in the evening is enough. Next year, we'll probably skip watering altogether on the more established plants, he says. Some, like the Fremontia, are thriving more than ever now. The thing is, native California plant species work perfectly in a native California environment. Some of them need dry summers, and all of them, sometime in their history, have survived survived extreme drought. Great comment there, Alan. Gail in Redwood Shores writes, I have a container garden. This is interesting because we haven't touched on container gardens yet. On my patio, roughly 30 to 40 succulents, and Gail is currently watering thoroughly weekly and using a moisture meter to determine if the bottom parts of plants are dry or not. She says her patio gets pretty hot during the day, about 4 hours of sun, though, then shade. Is that sufficient watering?
Well, if she's using a moisture meter and her plants are continuing to put out new growth and all that looks good, then I would say that it sounds sufficient. And in fact, you know, if you monitor your plants, you may even be able to cut back a little bit.
Yeah, your plants are talking to you. I'm not a huge fan of moisture meters and all that sort of thing. Your plants are going to tell you whether or not you're giving them the right amount of water, and they're going to start fussing and looking bad if you give them too little or if you give them too much. And so I'm a huge proponent and just getting in there, dig your hands down into that soil, see how deeply it's wet, make sure it isn't too soggy, and pay attention to what your plants are looking like. And that's all the information that you need to know if you're giving your garden the right amount of water.
Kathleen Brinsell, are there other considerations if you are in a situation where you have to use or you have to think in terms of a container garden because that's all you got?
That's right. And in the case of succulents, you know, they are very forgiving. In fact, I grow succulents, and they're lucky if they get water once every 2 weeks. And I know Robin Stockwell, a grower down in Castroville, agrees. You know, he goes off and surfs for 6 weeks or something, and if he remembers to water, fine. It does depend on where you live. If she's getting hot sun there, probably every 2 weeks should be fine. But I totally agree with Flora. Get your hands in the soil and just kind of see. And also the plants, the leaves of succulents will tell you if they're needing water. They might start to get a shriveled look or start changing color or something like that, particularly in hot sun. So
they do seem to be a very forgiving kind of plant.
They speak to you.
Yes. They're very communicative. That's an interesting thought. Succulents is big talkers. Fabian writes, we are using our lawn to play with our kids. Can you suggest some cover alternative, especially when there are going to be little people walking and playing barefoot on it? Andrea Hurd?
Well, again, I'm going to suggest native meadow grasses, and the type of grass that you choose will determine whether or not you can play on it and it's going to grow low. Carex panza is a popular one that's used as a native lawn substitute. It does fan out, and Carex pregracilis is another one similar. Both wetland plants, so tolerate wet and dry and heat and shade.
Flora Grubb, anything you want to add there?
Also, the tight ground covers like Dimondia and Creeping Thyme and some of those others that you can mix in along. Usually we suggest starting along the edge of the lawn, and they'll let them creep into the lawn, and they'll use less water than the grass does.
Gil in Richmond.
I'm 86 years old, a native of California, and I love gardening, have been doing it all my life. And just to address the last question on lawns, 40 years ago when I moved into Richmond, I took out my lawn and put in an artificial turf. It lasted for 25 years, and I just love it, you know. I replaced it after 25 years. So that's one way to go. But the reason I'm calling is because I want to address the person who loves gardening and doesn't have to buy anything. That's me. In our area, we have kind of the heavy adobe soil, which probably is most of the East Bay soil, I never use overhead sprinkling because it's most of it. You walk around, people have their sprinklers on, and most of it evaporates by the time the sun sets. It doesn't do anything like Mother Nature. Mother Nature takes all winter long to get that water down to where it acts as an active reservoir, and it moves slowly through the spring and summer through vapor action, and that's what I employ that factor.
Gil, do you find yourself trying to spread the word with your neighbors? I mean, do they listen to you when you say, look, you're doing it wrong?
They don't ask any questions. People don't want to know. People don't want to. They want to do what they want to do, and that's so I don't give them unsolicited advice. My specialty is I've been for more than 15 years. I've been growing wildflowers on public land with all total natural rainfall. This year, the flowers were beautiful. You think we had a drought? Well, in El Cerrito, things were wonderful. you do have to, you have to kind of understand Mother Nature and work with Mother Nature, and it's a passion for me, and everybody could learn it, but you don't have to buy anything for it. I don't ever use an automatic sprinkler system or any automatic. I don't use a drip system. Of course, with a heavy adobe soil, you just water deep like Mother Nature does. You figure out how to do that. Another little trick is I use dry mulching, because it's true that our heavy adobe will bake in the sun, and then you can't wet it for anything. But once you understand that, then you know how to get the water deep like Mother Nature does, you know.
Great points, Gil. I want to keep rolling because we just have a few minutes left, and I want people to have a chance. But that is a great point, and you raise something as well. And it's sort of a theme that keeps coming up again and again. You have to say, where is my yard located? What kind of soil do I have? And let the conversation move on from there. Thank you again, Gil. Shayla writes, can you name specific drought-tolerant grasses that one can grow from seed? 5 years ago, I got a mix for an eco lawn, which included clover, supposedly to provide nitrogen to the soil. Well, the clover took over. With long spaghetti-type vines, I've just laboriously eliminated the entire lawn and want to start over. Flora Grubb, I don't want you to get lost there on the phone. Any thoughts on Shayla's problem?
I'm not an expert on starting lawns by seed. I'd have to defer on that one.
Anybody here?
I think it's really hard to get a lot of grasses, particularly the more drought-tolerant native grasses, to go from seed. One that I do like to use is red fescue. It's not as drought-tolerant as some of the other ones, and it's not long-lived. It is lovely. It's first season or two, though. And if you can tolerate maybe redoing it or maybe mixing it with other more long-lived types of grasses, which is what I do, there isn't a great source of a lot of native grass seeds, although Larner Seed Company, and there's a few places around here that carries Larner seeds, does provide native grass seeds. And they are tricky to start from seed often, so you need to do a little bit of research on what they need.
Good point. Philip in San Francisco.
Yes, I work at the University of San Francisco, and several years ago I suggested that we plant only native grasses, and I do now see the problem that your guest just explained, but also native plants. It seems that the university is won several number of awards for beauty of the plants and grasses, but I've suggested that they use only native plants and grasses and put little signs to show faculty, staff, students, parents, alumni, and visitors that the native plants will work. But I'm wondering, are cities and counties of the state going to be putting restrictions that restrict the amount of water that large institutions can use? And What websites can I refer our people to get the native plants?
That's a great question, Philip. Andrea Hurst?
As far as what the restrictions are, you know, I think that I'm not sure about that. But as far as getting native plants, there's a lot of nurseries around here that are carrying native plants now. They're becoming a lot more popular. I think it's a great idea to label and to mark which plants are native. And I think that it's also very true. Native plants love our natural, you know, rain cycles and our climate. And so it's much easier to get them established without using a lot of water. I know as far as municipalities, the city of Oakland is using a lot more native plants and their, you know, the lands that they manage, both in the park for recreational use, as well as, you know, and there's sidewalk medians, as are a lot of places.
You see it all over the place. Mm-hmm. People are starting to get mm-hmm. wise to mm-hmm. this idea. Great points, Philip. Kathleen writes, a great way to see how local residents are using drought-tolerant native plants is to check in with your local chapter of the California Native Plant Society. Most chapters have free spring home garden tours, which can give gardeners some good ideas about converting their front and backyards to drought-happy gardens. That's a very good point. Lynn emails, I'm a landscaper as well. Many people are not aware they can capture the water that is running in their sink and bathtub while it's getting hot. I can save over 4 gallons a day, and it's often enough to water houseplants, container plants, or if I alternate days, I can water the garden around my house. Lynn is one of many people who've written in talking about how, you know, clever ways they're making use of water they've already used in the home. And it's our hope, Andrea, I heard, is going to provide us a list of some great resources for people who are getting into gray water that we will post on the website for this particular program after it's up. So moving along, Alan writes, make sure to mention, oh, here we go, laundry to landscape gray water programs. Alfred says, back in the 1960s era, dichondra, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, was popular as an alternative to lawn and was said to be low water usage. It had a little whimsy, as it was said you need less water and only have to vacuum it. No one today seems to have any knowledge of it, he complains.
Dichondra is readily available, and we carry it at Flora Grub Gardens, and you should be able, still be able to find it in nurseries, both in a green and in a silver color.
Any last thoughts, Kathleen Brenzel?
Well, I say some of the best advice I've heard is just go with nature. Look what's growing around your area. Take hints for the plants that you can grow from what grows naturally on the hillsides around there. Save your shower water. Take care of that soil and check your irrigation. Make sure that you're not watering sidewalks and running off, sending water off down the street. That's a great place to start.
Flora Grubb, quick thoughts?
Yeah, I think for many of us, gardening is a deeply satisfying activity that makes us really happy. And so don't let the drought keep you out of your garden. And don't let all of our advice overwhelm you when it comes to thinking about what you're going to do with your own little patch of earth. Get in there, start digging around, and the garden will speak to you, and you can get all the advice that you need to make something beautiful and that will bring you joy every day.
A quick word from Andrea Hurd.
I've been doing drought tolerant gardening in the Bay Area for over 20 years, and I think that, unfortunately, as a result of the drought, it's an exciting time for those of us who have been, because there is a lot of resources out there for everybody to use.
Terrific. Thank you so much. Andrea Hurd, owner of Mariposa Gardening and Design, Flora Grubb, co-owner of Flora Grubb Gardens in San Francisco, Kathleen Brenzel, garden editor for Sunset Magazine. A pleasure to talk with all of you. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. We get online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Rachel Miro, and this is Forum on KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.